everybody. So today we have Brian Carroll back on the podcast. How are we doing, Brian?
How you doing, man? Thanks for having me back on. I've been watching your YouTube channel, and it seems like it's grown. Like we almost have the exact rate of growth, it seems like.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, yeah, I'm glad we got to meet up again. And this will be the last podcast I do of the year. So this will be a good way to round out 2023.
And then we might do another one, like a part three, maybe. I don't know, like January-ish, late January, early February, or something. And we can maybe deep dive on a few things, depending on how much we get through today.
Sure. Yeah, man. So we were just chatting briefly about some of the social media trends, and you were very open last time we spoke about PED usage in powerlifting, but also like in bodybuilding. I mean, obviously it's something that is very rampant at the professional level. And one thing we are seeing, like I just saw a couple of videos put out on Sam Sulik, and he seems to be like the big trend these days. I actually don't know a ton about him other than that he's very young. I believe he's maybe 21, 22, something around there. And a lot of these guys, it's one of those things where I feel like as much as people might say you shouldn't do XYZ, same thing with women, whether it's plastic surgery or certain trends and whatnot, you can say it, but you can't prevent people from seeing the response that these people get. You can tell people, hey, don't do this thing. But if you are a teenager who wants more attention and you see that these people who are taking performance-enhancing drugs get that response, you're going to have an influence. So I just wanted to get some of your opinion on Sam specifically, but just the kind of that general trend we are seeing with younger and younger people.
That's something that I worry about with my daughters, man. They're 3.5 years old, and I'm thinking they may know that, dad and mom have like taught me right, but the allure of something they might have to fail and try it out, unfortunately. And I hate that, but everyone has free will. Everyone has to make their choice. So, man, it's like one of those shiny object things, man. It's like, even though some of these kids might have a good head on their shoulders, they see how much attention someone's getting on Instagram, or like more lately since COVID, TikTok or YouTube. Someone blow up and they'll sell their whole life out just to try to get popular on YouTube. Someone that comes to mind when we talk about that is what's the dude's name that passed away in the last year? The
Joe Linder.
team 3cc's or
Oh,
whatever.
Boston Lloyd.
So that was someone that a blind person saw that one coming. Right, going back 10 years ago when he was like blasting all this stuff, and he was on dialysis just a year or two ago, and he was talking about the amount of gear he was still taking. Like he was
Yeah.
like more than like my running cycles when I was pushing towards a world record. And he's like, oh, this is just HRT basically. And Palumbo is like, what? Like
Yeah.
that's not HRT. He would call him out on it. But nonetheless, people like Sam Sulik, do you know how many people I've seen come and go like that in the last 20 years? Like someone pop up, they're gonna be the next bodybuilder. Like we've seen it a lot with bodybuilding and powerlifting and strongman, and they do one or two shows, they do really well, they get hurt, they may get sick, or life takes over and then they're gone just as soon as they've come about. So it's hard to get people to like not follow what this dude is eating or this girl is lifting or what exercise they're doing. But it's just things are popular now with our phones, and so someone that doesn't know better can easily get sucked into doing one of the latest trends and whatever someone like Sam Sulik may be doing right now as far as gear dosage and nutrition and training. I mean, I see a lot of people for their back. Okay. I see a lot of people for people who've hurt their back with too much intensity, too much volume, too much frequency in their training. Very rarely do I ever see anybody for their back or for their lifting and say, you're not doing enough. You know what, Dave? You're not doing enough, man. We need to up your volume and your intensity, your frequency. You know how often I have to say that to someone that's injured? Hardly ever. I have occasionally some lethargic men and women that have lost their zest for life, and then you got to get them off the couch. They eat too much. But for the most part, everyone's overdoing it. Even when this person starts exercising and doing therapy, quote unquote, they start doing too much. They go from doing nothing to doing too much. So we're a country of doing too much, I think. We are beating things to death. And a lot of people be well served to not try to mimic someone like Sam and just start with the least effective dose. But these people have to learn the hard way, it seems, some of them.
Yeah, I think ultimately, and this just goes for life lessons, I think ultimately you get what you incentivize. And you look at the professional bodybuilding stage, right? And people would talk about, well, you're getting these bloated guts and you're getting these less aesthetic physiques. But it's like, well, yeah, but those people are winning. And the people who have the biggest, the most freak factor are winning. And it really wasn't until they actually made a whole new division, right? They actually made the classic physique that you
Yeah.
kind of got that to change a little bit. But again, you're incentivizing it by rewarding it. And in this day and age, I think the social media following and the clout and the attention for sure is
Yeah.
going to be something that most people look at as a positive. Again, generally a younger generation, but people who want to go into that or think that they want that as their lifestyle, I really don't know if that's something that, it's kind of hard to put that back in the box, right, once it's out. So I don't really know what a solution there is.
Well, it's like the people that I knew that when they started eating raw liver, I knew exactly why they were doing that. I'm like, huh. I said, where did you get this from? Please tell me it's not Liver King. Please tell me that your wife got you into this or something. Because there's definitely some benefits to eating organ meat. We're not going to deny that. But if the funny thing about that is these people that are like stuffing down raw liver every day. If they really think that's going to take them to the next level, bro, I don't know what to say. I don't even know how to react to that. If they really think that's all they're missing is eating some raw liver daily to take them to the next level, they were thinking it was going to have some kind of special growth hormone secretion and like taking Anadrol and like Tren at the same time just because you eat raw liver. Unfortunately, it's a little, it's not going to happen, right? That's not going to be what takes someone to the next level. With that said, you got to watch some people fail sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
You just got to
sure.
kind of sit back and say, okay, how's the liver going? Oh, it tastes terrible. I don't think it would have done very much for you. You could take some liver tabs or still get the nutrients from somewhere else, or you could not worry about the liver and get better sleep and eat better in general, go out for a walk every day. And that could be a good start instead of stuffing liver down your face, for lunch.
Well, I think also a lot of people don't see necessarily the high dropout rate. I mean, this goes for a lot of things. Like, I'm pretty into watching mixed martial arts, and people will see the
Yeah.
people at the top, but it's like, well, hey, you're not seeing the dozens and dozens of people. I mean, probably the 98% of people who try and fail. And when it comes to performance-enhancing drugs, the reality is there's a lot of people that don't talk about the health detriments that they went through that kind of caused them to stop along the way. And so you're really not seeing that. And partly it's people who just don't have big followings. Partly it could be due to embarrassment that you kind of screwed yourself over. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but you're not necessarily seeing those failures unless you have actual deaths, like you mentioned with Boston Lloyd or some of these other people.
There's been a lot of bodybuilders that have passed away in the last couple of years, more than I remember from like if you could look back. I know you're a fan of bodybuilding and fighting, so that's perfect because look back and think about in the early 2000s and the teens, how many bodybuilders you remember from that era dropping dead. I mean, we still have the guys from the late 90s and early 2000s that are Dorian, Lee. I mean, Ronnie's a different topic because he's from an orthopedic standpoint mangled, right? But his organs seem to be doing okay. I saw a video of Jay the other day stripping his shirt off for his 50th birthday, and he's almost got his, he doesn't have the hair he did when he was in his 20s, but he still has a full head of hair. It's amazing that he's been able to manage that. I think things are different now, man. It's a lot easier to get drugs. So people can find a source somewhere and they can hammer it. Whereas before in the 90s and 2000s, it wasn't prevalent. Not every person was making underground gear like they have been the last 20 years. Like it's changed a bit. So now you can have a dumb 20-year-old like me slam a whole bottle and say, well, I can just get another one for 10 bucks or 20 bucks or whatever. I can sell one to my friend and then it'll pay for mine so I can experiment and slam this whole bottle of Prope and see what happens tomorrow. So I think the availability has changed things too, and stupid ideas on the internet in general. Like we were talking about, like Reddit, people talking about what they've tried and these old steroid forums that I used to be a part of in the early 2000s. Steroid Superboard was one of them, and everyone would talk about the things that they were trying and whatnot. And yeah, it's an interesting time. A lot of bodybuilders have died, not so many strongmen or powerlifters.
Yeah, I do find that very interesting. So part of it, you could say, well, it's just we have so much social media now that you're just going to hear about it. Like, hey, maybe people were dying before and you just didn't hear about it. But to your point, it usually seems to be people involved with bodybuilding. And I don't know that much about strongman, but I would imagine that the doses these guys are using have to be similarly high, I would guess. Maybe though they're not using the diuretics as much, and maybe, probably not using as much insulin, I would guess. I'm not sure. So things like that maybe are not as harmful, but I'm not sure. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I guess there could be a point, especially with the strongman, the cardiovascular aspect. A lot of these guys are in really good shape, even though like a half Thor or Shaw are well over 6 foot, 6 foot eight-ish and 440 pounds. But I'm not saying their heart isn't enlarged and it's not unhealthy, but they got good cardio. Like they can carry a yoke for 50 yards no problem, and turn around and throw kegs over their head, and then do whatever they need to do. So I think they train, they're a little bit more cardiovascularly fit, even though they look like they're a lot more unhealthy because they have a belly, they don't have the six pack, but they're also not taking a shitload of diuretics and then cutting down and not drinking for 2 days, then flexing as hard as they can for 2 hours at a time. I think
Right, right,
that the drugs are bad and all those things, but when you start dehydrating someone, like what happened to Ronnie Coleman, I think it was in 2000, where he was. They're about to have to take him to the ER, but instead he drank a whole gallon of water and he kind of came back. But yeah, that to me is the most dangerous aspect of it, is the diuretics.
That seems to be the most responsible for the sudden deaths. Right. Like that, and insulin, sometimes you hear, I mean, your blood sugar just crashes and nobody's around. You mentioned the orthopedic issues that Ronnie's going through, and he unfortunately is a classic case that everybody references versus Jay. It's hard to know how much was genetic versus like could if he trained like Ronnie, would he have been any bigger? It's hard to know that. But several Mr. Olympias, maybe it wasn't eight Mr. Olympias, but he still did amazing and he seems like he's doing so well. Do you think that somebody like Ronnie, I mean, I don't know how many back surgeries he's had at this point, 9, 10, something like that. Do you think that that is beyond recovery for a normal life? I mean, obviously you and like Stu, you work with some of the top athletes in the world. What do you do with somebody like that?
Man, I wish I had a good answer for that, because he's had so much hardware put inside him that I don't know if it's a case that he went to bad practitioners, or if it's maybe a little bit of that, along with Ronnie being Ronnie and what we've seen with all of his documentaries and what he said since being basically in a wheelchair. He doesn't regret anything and he'll never stop training. And I've seen him post-surgically doing leg presses and seated swinging side lateral raises and swinging cable rows right after a fusion. You can't fix that. It's like someone coming in and getting their teeth done and going and chewing on a bunch of popcorn kernels and breaking their teeth and saying, "It's not fair. Like, well, you got to fix my teeth, man." It's like, what are you doing? Like, this isn't even close to like what you're supposed to be doing right now. You can't help someone like that. So my opinion is the same mentality that helped him get eight Mr. Olympias and be such a great bodybuilder even before he went to the dark side. The genetics and his work ethic, and that's the same thing that undid him. His stubbornness is the same thing that undid him post bodybuilding career. That same mentality, he hasn't changed. He still trains hard. He's still doing a lot of the things he shouldn't be. He goes to the gym at 4 a.m. still. It's like he ain't gonna change. No intervention or surgeon or coach is gonna be able to get through to him, I don't think.
Yeah, it's interesting to see because there's people like that, but at least he, I mean, obviously he stopped competing a long time ago. You have the other people who just can't stop at all. Like I don't know how much if you follow UFC at all, but Tony Ferguson, he just lost
Seven
his
losses in
seventh.
a row.
And it's like, man, this guy is 40 years old and just like I don't know if he has friends and family just telling him, like, what are you doing, man? Like, you need to stop. You're just getting like, I mean, and it's not like it's kind of close. I mean, he's just getting demolished in most of these fights. And you have some people who just can't let the competition go, whether they have to get a pro card or whatever it is. Then you have other people like Dorian Yates, who just seemed to be mentally very okay with just dropping, 50 plus pounds of muscle and just living a different life. And, most people would say that that is a much healthier way to go about it for sure.
Yeah, everyone's so different. If you look at, I looked the other day at his record on Sherdog, and he's coming up on 5 years since he's won, man. May of 2019 is his last win.
Yeah, well, once he fought Gaethje, he was supposed to fight Khabib. That was
Fought
rescheduled
Gaethje
to
here
fight.
in Jacksonville.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So 5 times he was supposed to fight Khabib and just kept getting canceled. And then he ended up fighting Gaethje. He cut weight twice for Gaethje, which was just idiotic, but he just wanted to show how tough he was.
Right.
And then he lost to Gaethje, and then he lost the option to fight Khabib, and then that was it. I mean, he just then Chandler,
Oliveira about Ripley.
Oliveira. Yeah, man, just down and down.
And then even guys that are like really good, but they're not like the top guy, like Darush, crushed them. You know what I mean? Like it's been a bad time. I don't know why he can't put it down, but I do know he has some mental illness that his wife actually Baker acted him a few years ago when they didn't give him the refight. So when Conor and Khabib had their thing, and then they were already planning ahead beyond him, he like lost his mind and had to get Baker acted and stuff. So I think that it's all he knows, man. He's a bit of an eccentric guy, right? I don't think that him training with Goggins was gonna, I didn't think it would do him any good
Right.
because he's never lacked
I was
conditioning.
gonna say it's not like he had a cardio issue,
He's got a brain and chin sensitivity issue, and he's just the game has passed him by.
Yeah.
It's time for the next thing, and I think that he doesn't know anything else. The way you train for years, just going to a basketball court and playing on a teeter-totter in the playground and all that would work for a while, but the game has changed a lot in the last 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I always feel bad for guys and just in a lot of endeavors that they can't let go. I mean, that's one of the tough things with certain career choices. Even social media, kind of going back to that, it's like if you're a woman and you build up your fan base on being really attractive, how long is that really going to last? I mean, maybe you have 10 years. If you're a guy and it's about like how great your physique is and like, you really, are you going to be doing like reaction video? I mean, I guess Greg Doucette is still doing reaction videos and whatnot, but for the most part, you're not going to be doing that into your 40s. And I'm actually happy when I see some of these guys who really do it well. They have a smooth transition. They turn it into coaching, and then they turn their coaching into a business. And obviously, there's a lot of charlatans and whatnot in the fitness industry. But when you can kind of go, because the nice thing about like business, having a business and running it is that you can keep doing that into, your 60s and 70s. If it's something that you enjoy, you can grow in different ways that unfortunately with many physically related endeavors, you just can't do.
Man, I see people do it with powerlifting. So I can speak
Yeah.
specifically on that, man. People are always, ch it's like a gambler. They're always chasing that next big high of winning, of getting their money back, of hitting that total, of getting that knockout. And I think that they're just forever going to chase it because they're looking for that, because the money comes with it, at least in fighting. But it's the feeling we get by accomplishing the goals, right? That feeling, you got to find it somewhere else. Like I never had a feeling that I liked so much other than being tired at the end of a meet, hitting exactly what I set out to do, feeling accomplished, being tired and sore, and having that high that night. But there's also a flip side to that, the low to a shitty meet or crappy meet, then that night and the next day is worse than the high is good. So you get addicted to this, you're chasing that high, and then you get more of the bad. You're like, no, I'm coming back after the high. And I think Ferguson has done that for 7 fights now. Because he's so good, it's just passed him by. He didn't lose for almost 10 years, right?
Yeah, I think he had a 12 fight win streak, I believe.
Yeah,
So.
and they had what was it, the Tiramisu Gate. They had him tripping over cords on April Fool's Day, 2018. Remember when he tripped and screwed his knee up?
No, I don't.
That's why they canceled on April 1st, the fight week. Tony Ferguson was doing an interview and tripped over the cords where he's supposed to fight Khabib, and that's when they pulled him because he blew his knee out.
No way. Oh, wow. No, I didn't know
And
that.
that set him down a spiral.
Yeah.
Obviously,
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
So, going to the, we talked earlier about how young some of this stuff is starting. I don't know what age you were when you started the performance enhancing side of things, but Would you have done it differently? I mean, were there main things where you said, hey, I really regret doing this or that, or things that you would tell people who are getting into it younger? I mean, obviously it's part of the elite lifting culture. So are there ways you would have done it more safely, or you think you did it pretty well?
I think I did it pretty well. But if I could go back, this is something that I warn the younger guys about. If they ask me or if they even care, I'll tell them they got to be careful of some of these drugs that change their personality. They don't make someone who's a very nice guy typically into an a-hole. But what they'll do is they'll magnify certain aspects of your aggressiveness or your determined nature. Or I've noticed with trend, especially with people, and if you're under the age of 25 and you're drinking a bunch of alcohol, that's like one of the worst things. I've seen so many people losing their minds, breaking stuff, drunk and disorderly, fighting people. Trend and liquor don't mix very well. And so I never got in any trouble, even though I probably deserved some back then. But one of the biggest things that I tell the younger people is, man, don't mess with the trend. Wait until you've maximized your natural potential or somewhat tapped into it. But these guys starting at like 20 and 21, it's too early. Now, I dabbled in some pro hormones in my early 20s, but I didn't decide to start getting on a, like a true cycle pharmaceuticals until I was about 23. So
Okay.
05-ish is when I started then. Here's the thing. There's two sides to it. So if I could have done it over, sure, maybe I would have waited until I truly maxed out my potential. But the problem is, I saw where the road was going. I was starting to dabble in some pro hormones. And I'm just like, what am I doing? I can't call myself drug free anymore. It's either shit or get off the pot, is the way I looked at it. So I decided to go. And I think that you could respect that, especially when everything that I was taking over the counter, pro hormone wise, was oral. Not good for your liver and kidneys. That some of that stuff was very toxic
Yeah,
to
sure.
the liver. So, but then the other side to that is, I kind of wish that I may have taken some performance enhancing drugs in high school because I didn't know that people did it back then. I would see some guys like catch me all of a sudden on the bench press, go from 275 to 325 in like 8 weeks. And I'm like, man, some of these guys out here playing football and baseball were juicing, and I didn't even know that. So I don't know, man. If I kn know what I knew now about how powerful a high school athletic
A scholarship or
legacy
something.
could be, yeah, like a legacy you could build, I may have done things different, but I'm okay with how they went now. I'm just thankful I didn't do anything too stupid in my 20s, taking too many drugs or anything like that.
That's really interesting, actually. You might be the first person I've spoken to who's openly or outwardly talked about, hey, maybe even doing it younger if I was going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Obviously, most people do say, hey, don't do it or don't do it for a long time. But you do look at somebody like an Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's like, look, man, I don't advocate it for anybody,
Right.
but there's no question that his entire life would be different if he didn't start at a very young age. I mean, it's literally what has created the Arnold Schwarzenegger we know. And there's frankly, unfortunately, a lot of people, actors and whatnot, who got the roles they have because of steroid use and everything. So it's like, well, as much as I'm against it, I can't deny that for a special few who have the genetic potential to be the best,
Yeah.
they probably, like, again, if they're already going to do it, they could probably argue to get a head start on it where it's going to help them achieve, whatever greatness they are trying to achieve.
Yeah. I think in a perfect world, everyone would just take care of their bodies and not push the limits. But we all push the limits in different ways and try to get away with certain things. And I wish there was no such thing as performance enhancing drugs and everyone could just move on. And not have to worry about everyone be on a level playing field, but unfortunately they do exist. And the only way I could be on a level playing field was to be participating. That doesn't make it right, or that's my excuse, but that's just why I did it. Now, I wanted to get as strong as possible. And frankly, I didn't care about like some of these guys, Sam Sulik and the people that follow those types. We didn't have a social media, so I wasn't like enthralled with that. I was more into Ed Cohn's book that I got from Amazon, The Man, the Myth, the Method, like reading through that. So I didn't have people online talking about drug use other than like some of the boards that was kind of more private. It's nothing like it is now. I mean, you have people on TikTok telling you their whole cycles and all these different things. So it's different. It's a bit
Yeah.
different now.
So one thing I'm wondering about is because I know you got started pretty young, and obviously you've had a whole career, and this probably changes with age, but one of the biggest things that you see over the last few years is talking about volumes. And some of these studies are talking about crazy high volumes, right? And it almost becomes a meme. People don't read the whole studies. They don't necessarily understand the context, but it was, hey, 40 sets a week, 52 sets a week in this newest study at the peak of the study. And I'm not really talking about anything there, but just generally, did you find that you had the best results for your goals from the mostly agreed upon numbers of 8 to 15 sets per week of hard sets? Or did you actually find that, hey, some of these really high volumes, these 20 plus, per body part, or in your case, per movement, per week, were really helpful?
Man, I think that the way I approached everything was the least effective dose. So if I could get stronger with five sets on that, that wasn't the case. So that's a bad example. But let's just say 20 sets of bench because I'd have to work up and, the squat the same thing. I would always go with the least effective dose. And I had the best success with diet, so body composition, drugs, body composition, and performance, with a medium dose of volume, intensity, and frequency. It's somewhere in the middle for me. It wasn't a super low amount of volume where it was like, I'm not even getting a pump and I'm done, right? For the strength training, you still get a pump, you still get filled out. But it also wasn't a grueling set after set after set of beating myself into the ground. So for me, it was more like a more of a medium approach with volume and intensity. And if I needed to scale up, I would a little bit, but most of the time, I didn't need to scale down too much. I was always just approaching it by how it felt.
So would you say like moderate, what's that, like 2 to 3 times a week frequency per movement, something like that?
So the intensity, well, I'm kind of getting at is the intensity and the volume, but
Okay.
frequency was always on the low end for sure.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so I would do like one bench day, one squat day, one deadlift day, and then one like upper assistance day. So it's technically two lower, two upper days.
Okay.
And that's the way I went about it pretty much. Now, in high school, I would bench 3 or 4 times a week.
Right.
It's just the way the coach said to do it. You know what I
Yeah,
mean?
yeah, yeah. Now what, okay, so pretty low frequency then. And then in terms
Very
of
low.
volume, you're just talking what? It's, 8 to 10 sets, something like that per week or higher.
Well, if I were working up to, let's say, a 1,000 pound squat that week, it's going to be at least 10 sets, if I
Right,
went
just to get
100 pounds
there.
of plate. Yeah, so it'd be at least 10 sets starting at like 5 reps and probably pyramiding up to singles or doubles. So that's quite a bit. And then from there, I would do probably 3 sets of 5 to 8 on like pause squats. Maybe it's walking lunges, Bulgarian split squats, belt squats, good mornings. I usually like to pick about three things to go with it. So one major movement, like a pause squat, a secondary movement, like a belt squat, and then something unilateral is what I'd finish up with typically for a squat day. Three
Okay.
sets of each thing, basically.
So did you find, I mean, obviously it's not just going to be squats, but did you find other, did you say, well, I guess a way to say would be, did you prefer squats as a main movement and then accessories? Or did you ever get into some of the West Side stuff where you were almost doing completely accessories and these variations a lot of the time of the
I
main
tried
movement?
it all. Yeah, I tried it all, but starting about 2004, I got away from the conjugate and just started being a lot more set on my main movements. But secondary movements, I would do a lot of the West Side stuff, board presses, block pulls, good mornings, pin pulls, those different types of things. Instead of it being my main movement, I would have it as a secondary one. And
Gotcha.
that just kept me prepared for the competition lifts a little bit better.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because that is something that I feel like we just kind of keep coming back to within the industry, from all the way from like Mike Mentzer's HIIT to,
Yeah.
some of like the really high volume stuff. And it's interesting and it's fun to experiment, but most people I know, they do kind of settle into those moderate ranges for a reason, right? I mean, it's probably what the average person is going to have pretty good success with. Although it actually almost surprises me that given how strong you got and how successful you were, that you were able to do that with just like one time per week. And it kind of makes you wonder, like, what was the driving force then to get you to be so successful? Do you think there was just a very large genetic component? Do you think you just knew how to program properly without adding a ton of volume?
Genetics definitely play a part with that. Response to drugs, response to stimuli in general. A lot of people that I've worked with that are at the top, they're hyper responders. And I was talking to someone this other day. They hyper respond to medicine. They hyper respond to drugs. They hyper respond to any stimuli, training,
Right.
food, and they just look at something and they get better. Other people, they can be taking everything in the book and you can't even tell they work out. They're very poor responders. So I think it was I had a little bit of an understanding early about training volume. I had good mentors about not training too hard. I trained in the same gym as Dexter Jackson. So the
Okay.
same guy that got me started got Dexter started. And so he
Oh,
taught me
wow.
the same stuff he taught Dexter. So Dexter would train 3 days a week, even like a
Total.
couple years into turning pro. Dexter would do
Wow.
chest and back, legs, shoulders, buys, and tries on Friday, and then nothing. No cardio, no nothing. Now he got better when he started training a little bit more, dieting more than 3 or 4 weeks, and then doing cardio.
Wow.
I've seen him. I've seen him, we're talking 15 years ago. I've seen him eat fried rice 3 weeks out from Olympia.
Yeah.
Like at the hibachi table eating fried rice. I've seen him do 405 for 10 bench press reps 3 weeks out from Olympia. I'm
Wow.
like, how are you still so strong? He's like, dude, I don't carb deplete.
Yeah, there's a buddy of mine. He's an IFBB pro now, pretty genetically gifted. And I remember him saying, like, yeah, this is the year I'm gonna take things really seriously. I'm gonna stop eating pizza during my prep. And it's like, man, like the level of dedication and the difference there is just it varies pretty starkly.
Yeah. What was the topic we were on before I started talking about Dexter? A training ball? Yeah, the same guy that got me started got Dexter started. So I had a good understanding of, hey, train 3 or 4 days a week. Don't beat yourself into the ground. You got the next 20 years to get strong. Here's where people are blowing themselves apart. They're benching 3 days a week. They're squatting and deadlifting multiple times a week. You just can't. He taught me you couldn't sustain. You can't sustain that. A guy named Skip Sylvester taught me these things, and he taught Dexter, and he taught a few other people that had some success. But that was instilled in me pretty early, about 16.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it's a harder answer for people because, and not to say like I definitely don't want to have people think, oh, well, it's just about how you respond or there's nothing you can do. Obviously, programming it and whatnot matters, but I think for a lot of us, there's this inherent desire to do more. It's, hey, I'm not getting enough results, so I'm going to lift twice as much or three times as much and more intensity. And I think sometimes there's just a realistic view of, hey, you got to do everything you can, but some of it is just a response to things, and obviously that's going to vary widely.
So circling back to why do I think I had success? I had an understanding of the programming, genetically pretty gifted, and sticking with something. No one sticks with things anymore. They do bodybuilding for 2 years, and they do strongman, and they do
Right.
Olympic lifting, and then I stuck with it. Like good, bad, or ugly, I just stuck with it year after year after year after year, and eventually I just learned enough of what worked for me and what I needed to do to get to the next level. And it just kept working for a long time. And when it didn't work, I had to get creative, think outside the box, and then, keep pushing forward. But I think that's probably a lot of it too, is just determination and sticking with something more than just a couple of years.
No, it's all good stuff, man. So I know we don't have like a ton of time today, so I want to shift a little bit into the next topic. But just as far as obviously your expertise these days, a lot of what you do is working with people with back issues, and so I see it among my friends, right? So just with dentistry, anybody who's performing surgeries, even in our 30s, they're starting to run into orthopedic issues because you're really, I mean, you don't think about it, but you're performing procedures all day. And you're kind of just in this position and you try to be ergonomic and upright, but it's hard. You try to get to different portions of the mouth in the case of dentistry or for various surgeons, different positions you have to get into. So I find that it's very different than the aspects that people run into with lifting. From what I see with lifting, you have overuse injuries and then you have specific acute injuries, right? Like you pull the deadlift the wrong way and you kind of tweaked your back. What I find with people with career related injuries, I guess it is an overuse injury, but it's just like this kind of chronic wear and tear. And when I had Stu on, one of the things we talked about is that it's pretty hard to undo that, or it's pretty hard to balance out if somebody's got 40 hours a week where they're in this, less than desirable, less than ideal position. So are there ways that you think somebody can use working out to, I don't know if it's whether it's strengthening the muscle itself or stretch the antagonizing muscles, anything like that, where somebody's putting themselves in these positions constantly to kind of either undo it or prevent against it getting worse?
I'm interested what Stu said about that. Like how you could, because he's like, he knows it's a tough thing. I think, did you, I'm sure you guys, I listened to the podcast, but I'm trying to think, you guys probably talked about stress concentrations. So you create stress concentrations in a posture that you keep for too long, especially if it's not in a neutral spine. So you have surgeons, dentists, computer programmers, they end up getting, a bit kyphotic and they get posterior disc bulges. Anyone that sits down for a long period of time, or someone that's leaning over, like a dentist, or like I said, a surgeon. I have a couple dentists that I work with, and sometimes they have a hard time getting to someone's back of their mouth, and they might be in a terrible position, turned over like this for, hours at a time.
Definitely.
And I try to get people to obviously be as ergonomic as possible. You already mentioned that, but man, spacing out their procedures the best they can so they're not killing themselves all the time. Have adequate help and adequate equipment to best support what they need to do. But at the end of the day, if they're in bad positions all the time, they're going to have some stress concentrations. I think that training in ways that are going to be not so hard on the spine and conducive to bolstering their athleticism. So, for instance, someone that sits all day, lean forward, doing surgeries and such, is not likely to do well with doing surgeries all day and then going right back to the gym and doing heavy squats and deadlifts because they've softened the annulus of their disc potentially sitting forward in a flexion like that. And sometimes the catalyst to the disc bulging is the added compression after a day of sitting in flexion. So that might be something that happens to people that I know that are in those positions that lift. So it's good to make sure that you give yourself time between the time that you're sitting all day or doing the procedure to going and lifting. And that's just settling that disc a little bit. It might be a tummy lie for a little bit of time. It might be stiffening the core a little bit. In between procedures, potentially, but definitely after the procedure, before this person may go and lift. But yeah, man, just not beating themselves up when they don't have to. Like, I understand some procedures will require someone to be bent over and hunched over, but not every procedure. So saving those dollars in the bank account and not using them up every single time they see a client or patient. I see it with personal trainers too. They beat the crap out of themselves just training someone and they're hurting. So what I have to do is get the personal trainer to sit some of the time, to stand some of the time. And when they sit with good posture, neutral spine, lumbar support. And when they stand, make sure they sag their knees a little bit and take a little bit of the stress out of their lumbar spine and make sure they're in a neutral spine to begin with. So just changing people's posture up is key. But you ask a tough question, man, and it really just depends on their person, their injury mechanisms, and what their goals are in life and what they're dealing with symptom-wise.
When you say, in the case of the personal trainer, for them to, like you said, sag their knees, you mean like bend their knees a little bit, and that takes pressure off the spine?
Yeah, just a little bit. So in Back Mechanic, Dr. McGill's book talks about finding that neutral spine by feeling your back muscle, back extensors. And then you can feel them turn off. That's your neutral spine when they turn off. And then by sagging the knees just a little bit, that takes the pressure and transfers the force onto the hips and the knees a little bit more than the low back extensors. So that's one little trick to be used for people. They say in weddings, don't lock your knees out, you're going to pass out. Well, don't lock your knees out because you're going to smoke your back too.
That's interesting. I had not heard that one before. I definitely find, yeah, the changing of the posture is helpful. It's funny how much I don't think that's something I thought about until more recent years, but even just sitting somewhere, how much you really have to change position. If you're just in one given position, even if you sit in that position or stand or whatever, it's a very comfortable position initially. if you are forced to be in that position for 12 hours, it becomes exceedingly uncomfortable. Even like, I don't know if this is common for everybody, but I know for me, if I get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, when I go back to the bed, I have to change the side I'm on because there's just this unnatural feeling of going back to that same side.
Yeah, so we talked about stress concentrations, and then we have that cascade of injury. It starts with discomfort and tightness, then it goes to pain, and then it goes to injury. So by switching up as you feel the discomfort, you're kind of staying ahead of that cascade. So you're right on about that. And I know people with perfectly healthy backs, right? They take an MR and they're pretty clear. They don't have a disc bulge or anything, but you put them on a transcontinental flight, sitting for a long period of time in a tiny little seat, they'll start to get hip, knee, and back pain out of the blue, seemingly. Those are stress concentrations developing, and everyone will have a capacity limit, but some of these people with acute injuries and such, they have a lot less of a capacity limit, and those are the people we
Right,
try to
right, right.
get better. Yeah.
I've kind of wondered that about as well. I've wondered about that as well, is that it seems a lot of people, I don't know how to define it. It might not be an actual injury. It seems like their capacity to withstand certain things goes down. So they don't have, like you said, maybe an image wouldn't show a bulging disc or anything like that. But so the example I'm thinking of that I've seen among several dentists and people who are even in like medical surgeries, they describe it not as a pain, but they will be in, again, in a position for 4 hours, 5 hours. And the way that it's described is almost like a back fatigue,
Yeah.
where like imagine if you're walking, we used to do these long walks in New York City when you're young, and you know, you're walking for 10 hours. And when you sit down on the chair, there's that feeling of like that relaxation.
Yeah.
Similarly, these people describe that, you know, they're doing surgeries 4 or 5 hours, and there's this fatigue. And if they were to lie down on a hard floor, there's that same kind of relief. Have you heard of that before?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Just yeah, I don't know. It could be a lot of things, man. I think that I know some people that their whole bodies, their feet start to hurt when they stand in one place for more than like 15 minutes. Everyone's so
Yeah,
different. I do
yeah.
think it is a capacity thing where someone's just that they know that their capacity is on the verge of being crossed. They're 4 hours in, they're finishing up, they're sweating, they're ready to eat. They're just It might a lot of the time it might be central nervous system fatigue too. They're just done. They're overstimulated, they're tired, they've been standing, their every system is just overloaded. They need a change and to be able to detox for a little bit. I've experienced that plenty of times. And what I'll do is just kind of go lie in my bed for a little bit by myself, get away from my kids, get away from my wife. I may have been doing consults all day in my office or with people in the gym, and I just decompress for a little bit. My knees don't hurt anymore. My feet don't hurt anymore. And I'm just kind of reset. I just need 20 minutes to go decompress. And I think
Yeah.
it's a mental fatigue for me more than anything.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to know physiologically what is causing that. You know, you could say, hey, well, when there's a pump and that feeling, there's this metabolite buildup. We kind of know at least to some degree what is causing that. But that kind of just general like fatigue pain that I hear a lot of people talk about, I don't know what that is. But it also makes me wonder if somebody comes to you and they ask this, or I've seen it with like physical therapists. I could see two schools of thought. I could see one school saying, hey, if you're having pain in this position, when you're like your PT or your rehab should be strengthen that position. So do more of it, you know, maybe go against the wall and you know, go keep your back upright and whatnot. The other argument I could see being the total opposite, which is, hey, you're already kind of forcing that muscle to be worked so often that when you're, you know, home, just decompress it entirely. Don't put any extra stress on it. I don't know if you have thoughts on that if somebody comes to you with something.
Depends on what muscle and what their symptoms are. So, depending on if someone comes to me for a back injury or they want their lifts assessed, I do a full assessment on them. And if it's more back centric, we'll test them in all kinds of different shear loads and compression and flexion and lateral flexion and rotation. And then, depending on what I find there, then I can play with the nerve roots a little bit. I can play with the sciatic and the femoral, and then I can know if Are we dealing with like a disc bulge that isn't showing because they're in a neutral spine when they're in the MRI, or just someone that's just doing too much and they have no core endurance, they have no muscle, they might be a little bit unstable in the spine where the discs have kind of flattened a little bit and gotten soft, and then you build them back up and they don't really have any specific symptoms or triggers. They just get fatigued sometimes. So some people are just so out of shape that anything that pushes them a little bit, they start to hurt and get tight. So it really depends on the person, and that's why the assessment and treating that person uniquely is so important.
Yeah, sure. What is that test for the sciatic nerve where, what's it called, a slump test or something, where you bring your head forward? What is that called?
Yeah, so you do a slump test, then you play with it. So you play with the neck some because you're actually moving the spinal cord when you go into extension and flexion. Then you play with extending your knee and flexing your knee.
Right.
And depending on what you find there, could determine if you have maybe a L4, L5, a 5S1 disc bulge, or might push you into a different direction. It might be femoral nerve root, it might be higher up. So yeah, it's about the assessment. And sometimes a little bit of nerve flossing can free up that friction they have, and their back pain and or leg pain, glute pain, hamstring pain may dissipate right away, or it might really flare up, depending if that disc bulge is really encroaching on that nerve root, at the varying levels.
So that's interesting because I've heard of the slump test before, and I've seen people who test positive. I thought it was kind of a you test positive for or you don't. But did I understand that correctly? You're saying that which area kind of causes it? Like, so for example, if you're bringing your head down and that makes you feel it, that might indicate something differently than if you're, let's say, bringing your toes back towards you.
Yeah, so it could be, it could vary person to person. So the slump test is just very nonspecific. We know someone, a lot of people will, when they flex their back, it hurts. Okay, well, what kind of pain is it? Now let's play with the nerve. Are we extending into extension? Do you have a nerve underhook? Do you have an overhook? Does it feel better when you actually bring the chin down? Now, what are we doing with the leg? So whenever you teach someone to do a nerve floss, like a sciatic nerve glide, we're going cervical extension, knee extension harmoniously, and we're just flossing the spinal cord up and down. For some people, that will light them on fire. Other people, it'll free up their nerve friction, and then they'll get relief from the pain and allow them to start healing more. So it's very nuanced. The slump test is just the start to that.
Interesting. Okay. So maybe like a last topic to wrap up here is this is related to back, but more like the musculature of the back. One of the guys actually who passed away, we talked about all these guys who have passed, Doug Brignoli. I don't know if you know the name. He passed like maybe 2 years ago. And he was older. I mean, he wasn't one of the very young guys. He's probably close to 60. But he was kind of the biomechanics guy, or at least that's how what he proclaimed to be. And I would say in the last maybe 5 years, we've seen a lot more talk about biomechanics and these, Kasim Hansen and talking about these different ways to move. And a lot of it is with back. And I think that makes sense because, not that there aren't better ways to work your triceps, for example, but it's I would say much more simple than back movements because there's so much musculature that makes up the back. So I'm wondering if you have taken any certain approaches there where we're looking at this and saying, hey, what is biomechanically most advantageous for muscle growth? If you are looking at, hey, biomechanically, what is the best way to lift for longevity? Because one of the things we will talk about that like the biggest killer of your gains, quote unquote, is injury. And it
Yeah.
doesn't matter how biomechanically advantageous your movements are if you're getting injured.
Yeah, availability supersedes ability. So you can have a 75%-ish dialed in form. May not be perfect. It may not be the best for muscle growth, but if you do it for 35 years straight, you might be completely jacked out of your mind. Whereas someone else is like perfect with their form and whatever else, but then, they hurt themselves. Or it isn't perfect, but they get a lot of muscle. Like Ronnie Coleman would be an example of someone whose biomechanics weren't great, but he got great muscle growth because he would use the lifting muscle English to get a squeeze with a 500-pound barbell row. So while it was destroying his spine, him rowing 495, getting that, he grew some humongous lats, rhomboids, and traps and everything. So, man, I've seen a lot of people also be able to deadlift a lot of weight with a kyphotic rounded over spine with some movement there. You can generate a lot of power off the floor by rounding over a little bit at the start, but it's important to keep it locked in after that and not moving it under the load. Some people pull more that way, but they also destroy their back faster. So I think that a little bit of body English for hypertrophy is great. I don't think a perfectly locked in, rigid range of motion is going to be ideal for the best hypertrophy, but for strength training and staying resilient for the long term, when you're not trying to do specifically hypertrophy, I think having locked in core and torso and nice and smooth with everything, that's the way to go. But like a Jay Cutler style bodybuilding, maybe not Johnny, maybe not so much Johnny Jackson, Branch Warren, Ronnie Coleman style, but something like a Jay Cutler is probably, the best way to biomechanically build muscle, but not for strength training or resilience necessarily.
What I'm interested to see is, I don't know if you followed some of the research that's come out on lengthened partials and, talking about basically it seems like that is the big driver for hypertrophy. And so when it comes to back training, I think an argument, because many people have said that a little bit of momentum, a little bit of oomph into the back work is really helpful. And I just know that I always found when I was younger trying to do these perfectly strict rows, it just didn't feel that stimulatory because the weight you had to use to get a clean rep up to, let's say, like your navel was so much less than what you were capable of pulling otherwise. And so with some of this lengthened partials, it could be the best of both worlds where it's like, look, you can load up the barbell, but still use good form, but accept that you're maybe only going to get half the rep. And now you don't have to injure yourself, but you can still get that heavy stimulus. And I wonder if that's going to get more and more adopted with back work over time.
Yeah, I think that that's probably where the magic is. A little bit of heavy weight, pretty good form all the time. Maybe not perfect form, but good form for a bodybuilder, you could say. And that's one mistake that I see people make when they're trying to rebuild their back or get out of pain with their back is they adopt a bodybuilding approach. And a lot of the time it's machines. It's a lot of shear load, like a seal row or something. They're like, oh, I'm fine, I'm not moving my back. And I'm like, that's a lot of compression you're using there with the bodybuilding. So bodybuilding, and at least from a starting over standpoint, bodybuilding is one thing that I see people stay in pain doing because they're still doing the rowing and stuff. And they think that, oh, it's fine because I'm not moving my back. Bodybuilding is a bit different than someone trying to recover their back. And that's one thing I see people do that stay in pain.
That's interesting. So, because I would have thought the same thing. I would have thought, okay, you know what? Like the strongman stuff, you're in these awkward positions, the heavy deadlifting. But you're saying even if somebody is keeping quote unquote pristine form, they can still have continued issues.
Yeah, especially if they're doing a bunch of heavy chest supported rows. Like, I'm not moving my back, and my back never hurts me while I'm doing it. Well, what I'll have to do if someone can't demonstrate something that hurts their pain, I have to look at their programming, I have to look at the exercises they're doing. And for that person, it might be a cumulative thing, just like the surgeon or the dentist. It isn't the first hour. It's the cumulative time after time, 5 hours at a time in a kyphotic position that gets them. They're not feeling it that one time. It's like, there it is. That's that thing. It's cumulative for them.
Well, that's bad news for a lot of us lifters, man.
It
So,
is.
what do they do? I mean, you just got to stop doing all the rows and everything.
Probably doing too much volume and frequency. So that's one thing I'd get them to do is back off the volume. Back off the frequency. And if that doesn't fix it, then back off the intensity a little bit. There's all kinds of little things you can play with. But man, I know some people, the only time they throw their back out is with a deadlift or a barbell row. As long as they don't squat or barbell row or deadlift, their back never gives them any problems. I have some people that can deadlift just fine. If they do a barbell row, they're toast.
Interesting.
Everyone's so different.
Very individual. Cool, man. Well, I know we both got some Christmas festivities going on, so we'll wrap this one up. But I'm sure we'll talk again. But in the meantime, where can people find your stuff?
Yeah, you can find me at poweractstrength.com or on social, Brian Carroll 1306. And let's do another talk in the new year, man. I'm glad everything's good with you. Merry Christmas to you, and thanks for having me on. All
All right. Thanks again, man.
right, cheers, brother.